There are a lot of quarterbacks in the NFL draft this year. My name is Ben Solak, and I host the Ringer NFL Draft Show with Danny Kelly, Danny Heifetz, and Greg Horlbeck. We cover trades, free agency, and the draft, which is, obviously. We'll tell you about everything, which includes which quarterbacks are good, which quarterbacks are bad, and which quarterbacks are just Kirk Cousins. That is the Ringer NFL Draft Show. Search the Ringer NFL Draft Show on Spotify.
This episode of The Town is brought to you by FX's The Bear, starring Jeremy Allen White, Ayo Edebiri, and Eben Moss-Bachrach. Season 2 follows as the crew work to transform their grimy sandwich joint into a next-level spot. It turns out the only thing harder than running a restaurant is opening a new one. Television Academy members can watch all episodes at fxnetworks.com/FYC.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
It is Monday, March 4th. Both Disney and Netflix made some big changes to their movie studios last week, and the impact could be pretty significant. On the Disney side, Sean Bailey stepped down. He's run Walt Disney Studios for the past 14 years. That's the main Disney live-action studio, not Marvel or Star Wars or animation. They primarily made remakes of the classic Disney animated hits and other IP like Cinderella, Aladdin, last year's Little Mermaid, the Mulan movie. Mostly successful, but there's been recent weaknesses. Little Mermaid, as I mentioned, and Haunted Mansion both underperformed last year. Bailey is leaving Disney to be a producer on the new Tron movie, and in his place, Disney promoted David Greenbaum, who currently runs Searchlight, the specialty division they inherited from Fox. It currently has Poor Things in the Oscar race. They've done Nomadland, Jojo Rabbit, The Menu, The Favorite, Birdman, a bunch more. Very different kinds of movies. It's an art house guy now running the studio division that makes big tentpole movies for a global audience. An interesting move that probably signals Disney is interested in doing more than just the remix. And over at Netflix, they've just hired a producer named Dan Lin to run the film group. He replaces Scott Stuber, who launched the Netflix film division 7 years ago. Dan's a very successful producer. He's made commercial movies like the Lego movies, It, a few for Disney like Aladdin, that Haunted Mansion movie. He runs a successful company called Rideback. It's kind of funny. Dan Lin has made movies for Disney and is now running Netflix. Greenbaum was a finalist for that Netflix job before he got promoted to Disney. Very incestuous. But at Netflix, it's an interesting time because they've said they're going to make dramatically fewer movies. They have been. They were doing 80 movies a year at one point. Now they're going to do like 30. It's a pretty significant drop. And they say they want better movies, don't we all? So what does this actually mean? That's what we're going to get into today with Lucas Shaw from Bloomberg, our Monday guy. Big changes at Netflix and Disney, and maybe the kinds of movies that get made. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Lucas Shaw from Bloomberg back again. Welcome, Lucas.
Great to be here to talk about the most powerful job in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to describe it, because at least in the film side of the business, the head of the film group at Netflix has been the most powerful job in the film business, at least from a volume perspective. I mean, Scott Stuber.
The biggest job.
Right.
You make the most movies with the most people all over the world, the most biggest budget, all those
things. Right. Exactly. 80 movies Scott Stuber once made in a year. I mean, it's amazing that that was a thing that happened. One company put out 80 original movies in a year. And we see now with the hiring of Dan Lin, who's a very prolific producer, nice guy, and a business sense guy. He's got an MBA from Harvard. He is coming into this company as the new head of film, and he's got a very different mandate from the previous regime. So what do you make of this? What does this hiring signal about the kinds of movies, the volume of movies, the output from Netflix going forward?
His hiring is a sign of a move that, or a shift that I think was already underway, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they brought in Scott Stuber to build the film studio. They had already been making original television. They'd done a few movies, but nothing big. And Scott had to essentially create a new strategy, some of which he got to pick and some of which was pushed upon him by Ted Sarandos and Reed Hastings and others. And that was like, make as many movies as possible, make as many good movies as possible, make some bad movies. Dan Lin is being brought in to do something different. The strategy's already set, right? It's not like they're bringing him in to reconceptualize what they are doing.
Right. And the strategy is less and hopefully better.
I think it's going to be a lot of making the types of movies that make, if you're not going to release movies with a proper theatrical release, as Netflix does not want to do, then the best movies are the movies that were like really big on cable in the 90s. And I think you're going to see a lot of comedies, romantic comedies, thrillers, like that type of movie. You'll see a couple of movies for the Oscars and some of that they can acquire. You'll see a couple of big budget movies, but the Stuber had started making a lot of these like epic movies that cost $150 million plus. And that just doesn't make sense if you're not putting them in theaters.
Yeah. No more Gray Man. No more Red Notice. No more Rebel Moon, the Zack Snyder movie that costs God knows how much money. And
you're not really excited for part two? It's coming soon, I think.
I know. I'm excited to see how part two does, because part one did not light the world on fire and Netflix was already all in on part two. And I think they are probably regretting that. But I agree with you. I think it means smaller swings by Netflix. I mean, Bella Bajaria, the chief content officer, she comes from television and she has now a person in to execute her strategy on how she wants the movie studio to work. And I think that, you know, they can get these big budget tentpole movies from the other studios. And if we see the list of the most watched movies on Netflix, time and time again, it is the acquired stuff. I mean, I just looked at the year-end 2023 numbers from Nielsen, and the biggest movie on Netflix last year was the Super Mario Brothers movie, which was a Universal theatrical release that went to Peacock, then went to Netflix. So they can get whatever they want. These studios are desperate to sell them the big titles. They don't need to make Red Notice anymore. They just don't. That was a strategy that was born out of the other studios not selling them their big titles. So what are they going to do? They're going to spend less. They're going to focus on the niche categories of movies where the studios aren't making a lot of competitors. And they're going to make fewer of them.
What I don't get about that is there was never a total cessation of licensing on the movie side. The Sony deal, which is Netflix gets its big licensing titles from Sony and from Illumination/Universal. And Sony re-upped its deal, or Sony signed the deal with Netflix a couple of years ago. Illumination already had a deal with Netflix, which they just renewed. So it's not like they're suddenly getting these big movies. They just
Yes, they are. They're getting all the Warner's movies. I mean, I looked on there last night. The Batman and Dune and all of these big Warner movies are now on Netflix because Warner Brothers needs cash because they're going under from the crushing debt. And they're getting tons of movies from them.
Well, Dune, I'd fit more into the Top Gun model where it's smart for Netflix because they know that there's going to be interest in this title of a sequel ahead of the release and they can serve people. And if you're the studio and you want to, if you're Warner Brothers and you want to generate awareness for Dune 2, unfortunately for you, having Dune on HBO Max doesn't do a lot for you. Putting Dune on Netflix does.
I get that, but there's stuff beyond the promotional stuff. There is deep library that is going over to Netflix. Disney's doing it too.
I think it's more on the TV side. The movie stuff, people were never as reluctant to license.
Okay.
Except for the first run titles. Anyways, yes.
Regardless, is that stuff is the stuff that performed. Now, I think Bella Bajaria would like the Netflix originals to perform better in numbers, and maybe that was part of the problem. And that's why you have a guy like Dan Lin, where if you look at his resume, he has made big all-audience global franchises like the Lego movies. He's made the It franchise. He did Aladdin at Disney. Like, these are movies for global audience. They're also pretty expensive movies, so we'll see what the budgets are like. But this is a guy who has commercial global tastes.
Yeah, and his big movies, at least in a couple of cases, haven't been crazy expensive, right? Like the Lego movie is probably the most profitable movie he's ever made.
Aladdin did $1 billion.
Yeah, that's true. I for some reason don't associate him with Aladdin, but the track record for his movies is really, really strong. Maybe he can take this job right as Godzilla versus Kong doesn't work, or maybe that can be his sort of his final great act as a producer.
Oh, he produced that as well?
He's an executive producer on most of the Godzilla movies.
Huh, interesting.
I assume that dates to his Warner Brothers time, but I could...
Yeah, maybe.
Were you surprised that they picked Dan Lin as opposed to some of the... Well, let me finish my question.
Okay.
As opposed to some of the other people who were up for the job?
No, this seems like the perfect fit. And I think that knowing Bella, she likes that he's entrepreneurial. He started his own company. He's got that business background. If you know him and sit with him, he's an adult in the room. He's not one of these like fly-by-night film producers who's all over the place. And he is like, seems like a real smart business / creative executive type. He also was up for the DC job at Warner Brothers, and they couldn't make that deal work. So he's sort of been in play. And I think that she probably saw those headlines and said, oh, maybe this guy is right for us. And, you know, there were some other names that were out there, Wick Godfrey, Sean Bailey, a couple others that have had big jobs at studios. But this guy makes sense.
But the other final contender is the other guy we're going to talk about.
Sean Bailey.
No.
Who?
David Greenbaum.
Oh, Greenbaum was the candidate for the Netflix job?
He was the other finalist.
Oh, that's news. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Do you think that helped him get the job?
My understanding is it did. I don't know for sure, but I think there was a pretty heady, like 72 hours where Greenbaum was up for the Netflix job, I think got offered the Netflix job or was at least considered a finalist, and then did or did not leverage that to get the job at Disney because Sean Bailey had made it clear that he didn't want to stick around in that current role. He either wanted to take on a bigger role or wanted to leave. And yeah.
Because my understanding is that the Greenbaum thing was in the works for months, which would have predated even Stuber leaving.
I probably was some version of expanding his role or building a bigger job had to have been in the works. Disney doesn't make a change like that, just like on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
But I do think that him having the leverage of being up for the Netflix job helped.
Oh, interesting. All right. So that's a good transition. Let's move into the Disney stuff, because the other big news this past week was Sean Bailey, who has run Walt Disney Studios, the live action arm, has stepped down. He's out after 14 years. And in is David Greenbaum, who has run the Searchlight Studio for the past couple of years. He is not just getting the Sean Bailey role, he is also getting control of 20th Century Studios, which is interesting because that has sort of, they inherited that from Fox, and it's been making a combination of, you know, legacy IP movies like Alien and Planet of the Apes, and also more original movies. And I think this is actually a pretty big change for Disney strategy-wise. I think that they recognize that just playing the hits and doing what they've done for, you know, the past decade on the movie side, which is big budget adaptations of previous animated hits, that's not good enough anymore. The audience is kind of sniffing that out and wants something at least a little bit different and unique than simply playing the hits. And I think Greenbaum's mandate is to come in there and take a few swings to try to create some new IP.
Does Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, take any responsibility for that strategy? Or do you think that Sean Bailey leaving is basically putting the blame on Sean for the strategy?
No, that was Iger's strategy. If you look at what happened at Disney in the early 2010s, they had a number of misfires. They had a guy in the film job, Rich Ross, who probably should not have been there. He was a TV guy. And they made some expensive flops that were original movies. John Carter, they made Tomorrowland, they made Prince of Persia, they made The Lone Ranger, and those did not work. They said, all right, screw this. We're just going to make hits. I mean, it sounds like a cliche from 30 Rock, but they're like, we have this library. Let's just make Beauty and the Beast. We'll make Aladdin. We'll do Cinderella. We'll do a Maleficent movie. Like, that was the strategy for a long time. And I think that now this exit is a chance for them to reevaluate a little bit and say, okay, we're coming out of COVID. The audience is not as automatically hot on those movies for whatever reason. They're still going to do some of them, but they're also, I think, going to take some different swings and try to do something maybe a little bit more original.
I get the same sense that you do, that there will be more original ideas. You don't bring in someone who has primarily experience making sort of smaller and original films and is not a kind of studio sequel guy if that's all you want him to do. And there'll be, you know, I think they'll still make some of those Disney, you know, the Disney live action reimaginings, but they'll be more selective about it. They'll have the movies for streaming and then they'll have the movies through 20th, which is sort of weird that Disney still has that label. But if that's a, if that's a label for, you know, making the next Guillermo del Toro movie or whatever it is.
Well, there is a long history of Disney having more general audience label. I mean, look, they had Touchstone for many years. They owned the freaking Miramax label for many years. I mean, that was initially an art house label, but they started making bigger budget movies under that label. And, you know, that 20th can, it can be the place for those kinds of movies. I mean, I use Free Guy as a template for the kind of movie that I think Greenbaum wants to do at Disney, which was a, you know, big budget Ryan Reynolds movie, original IP, but it had the all audience feel to it. It was big star driven, you know, commercial director. And during COVID, it made $330 million. Like without COVID, that movie probably would have done $400-500 million and started a franchise. They still may do another one, but that's the kind of movie.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
What's a movie that came out last year that you think Disney should have made that they didn't because they've been so franchise obsessed?
Well, I would use Barbie as the example. I know it's easy to pick the number one movie of the year, but Barbie is an example of an IP-driven film that defies expectations. The problem with a lot of the Disney movies has been it's exactly paint by numbers what you think it's going to be when you see the title. And that's by design. Some of these adaptations of the animated movies are literally shot by shot, where it's like, oh, then Ursula the Witch does this and goes up to, like, I recognize that from the animated movies. Barbie was a auteur-driven filmmaker using the IP, but doing something subversive with it that Disney is typically not doing in live action. They do it at Pixar, but not at live action. And it was a success because it was not what you expected it to be. And I think that is the approach that they need to take with some of these IP-driven films.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of people say that Barbie should have been a Disney movie that they would never have made.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the Illumination movies. Those are often movies that Disney wouldn't make. You know, they wouldn't.
Yeah, but that's fine because Disney just has a different brand in animation. Like now they, you can argue that they need to rethink it because Pixar has had a rough couple of years and Walt Disney Animation Studios has had a rough couple of years. And so they need to rethink what a Disney animated movie is, much as Jeffrey Katzenberg did in the 90s. But I can't fault them for not. I mean, in many ways, Chris Meledandri positioned Illumination as a counterpoint to what Pixar was, because Disney was sort of the establishment. And so he found another lane for himself, which is now working tremendously.
Right. And I think in live action at Disney, they will try to find a new lane as well. Iger, that strategy that Iger implemented and Sean Bailey executed was a short-term strategy. There's only so many hits in the library, and there's only so many times you can go back to the trough. Long-term, for the health of the company, they need new IP. They just do. The other studios need it too, and they're leaning a lot on the old stuff. But if these companies want to exist in 10, 20 years, they got to create new franchises. And that hasn't really been happening. I mean, Disney live action has created zero new franchises since 2010, 2011. They've reinvigorated a lot of old ones, and they've tried a couple times. They tried with the BFG, the Spielberg movie. They tried with A Wrinkle in Time, with the Ava DuVernay movie. They tried with Artemis Fowl, which kind of got sucked into the pandemic, but none of those worked. And now I feel like they have new creative leadership and maybe they can make some of them work.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. I'm looking through the biggest movies of each of the last few years. I mean, what's the last new franchise that was created?
Barbie.
We're calling that a franchise?
Oh, yeah. They're going to do 5 of those movies. Maybe not in the next year or two, but they will do more of that. Are you kidding?
Yeah, okay.
And Mattel now will have a little cachet to get others to do more Mattel toy movies. So both Barbie and Mattel are franchises now.
What about Dune?
Dune is a remake of a 1980s movie, which is a remake of a book.
But Barbie is...
Barbie's a toy. It's not a new concept, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Dune. I mean, you could say that, but I give it a little bit less credence just because the movie's been done before.
Yeah, because there just haven't been that many. I mean, I'll be curious what happens with this is unrelated, but what happens to Barbie if... I assume they're not going to have Greta come back and make a bunch of them.
She might produce.
Yeah, no, I'm sure she'll put a name on it. But
yeah.
John Wick. John Wick is probably one of the newer franchises.
It's got to be almost a decade old, right?
Yeah, that's old. They're pumping that stuff out, but it's old. I mean, I don't know. The last few franchises? Sonic the Hedgehog?
Yeah, Sonic.
Would you consider A Quiet Place a franchise?
Yeah.
They're at number 3 or 4 at this point. So
yeah maybe.
The horror, there are a few.
There are a lot of horror stuff. And you could argue that there's going to be a lot of Megan movies now. And maybe, you know, they're going to do more Five Nights at Freddy's.
Right.
It.
Well, but those are Stephen King books. I mean, is there going to be more It after the two?
No, but you could try to come up with a third one if you wanted to.
I take your point. That there aren't a lot of franchises being created out there. But that doesn't mean that Disney shouldn't be trying. They absolutely should try, because Disney is the best at exploiting franchises of all these companies.
They have been a font of creativity over the years. That's what made Pixar so great. It's what in a lot of what they did with Marvel made it so successful. And they just, as we've discussed before, they need a new creative direction at the company. And look, we'd been talking for months about, were they going to make any change at the film division? Because Bob Iger has said whatever was happening wasn't working. And even if you can blame him for a lot of that, because people were essentially executing his strategy, bringing in a fresh voice or someone who has different ideas means that there'll hopefully be a little bit of a change in Iger recognizing that things have to be done differently.
Yeah. The counter here, obviously, is Disney at its core is a family company, consumer products company, theme parks company, flywheel company. And the things that work best for Disney are all audience, global, known IP franchises. And if this hire at the studio suggests they are going to go try to make mid-budget comedies and thrillers and more adult general entertainment offerings, that is not best for Disney, because those don't translate into lunchboxes and pillowcases. They should just be focusing on the biggest and most impactful. And it's a version of what's happening, the debate in streaming as well. Should they even have Hulu as a general interest streamer, or should they just go all in on Disney Plus and be the global family product? I hear those voices and I know that Disney makes a lot of money, but I don't think you can be the Walt Disney Company in 2024 and beyond and not also have general entertainment.
Why do you think that way?
Because they want to be considered on the scale and level of a company like Netflix. They don't want to ultimately be eaten and become the family arm of a bigger company. And if you want, it's like, why is Disney in sports? Because sports is part of the overall entertainment ecosystem. If you want to be a big player, you have sports.
Yeah, but being the place of Marvel and Star Wars and all those things, that's still big, broad entertainment. It's franchises. And sports fits into that. There's a difference between, I think you can make general entertainment that sort of fits into the broader Disney strategy. The question is, do you make general entertainment that doesn't have the toy theme park ride component to it?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And that's right. The debate internally I've heard at Disney is, should we be doing the one and dones? Should we, on the film side, be doing films that are great and may make money and may get us attention, but can't turn into consumer products and theme park rides. Same as like, should they own FX?
It's the debate over whether the Fox deal was a good one, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yes, they got The Simpsons and Avatar, but they also got FX. And like, they're not doing any more seasons of Shogun after this Shogun run ends. Like, it's a one and done, and you're not going to put Shogun.
There's not going to be a Shogun ride at Disney World.
No.
You're not going to have a bunch of Shogun Halloween costumes.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I don't agree with that line, by the way. I think that Disney should be in general entertainment. You hear that often, and that was the justification for the Iger and Sean Bailey strategy. It's like, we all made fun of Aladdin and the fact that Will Smith was doing Robin Williams karaoke in that movie. But that movie made $1 billion and it reinvigorated the Aladdin franchise for a new generation, which sold a lot of toys and helped the parks. So, like, that's the Disney business.
I don't know where I land on this one. I really don't. I see the value of both arguments, and I think it's really important for these companies to focus right now. And I do sometimes think that Iger and Disney are trying to do too many things at the same time. But it is also very limiting for the company if they only want to make a specific type. It's a version of saying, like, just make the hits, right? Like, only make the big, broad, four-quadrant stuff. And sometimes you don't know what's going to be a big, broad hit until you try something new.
Exactly. And I think that's where they're going to have a period of experimentation. I don't think Walt Disney Studios is going to start making Poor Things. I mean, that is, like, probably the raunchiest movie that Disney has ever released, but I do think they're going to accept a little bit more risk to try to build some new franchises. All right, Lucas, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, we're back with the call sheet. Craig, did you see the trailer? The Taylor Swift movie, Taylor's version, coming to Disney Plus, March 14th.
Yep, I did see it. It was impossible to miss.
Oh, God, I know. Like, God forbid there be a Monday without some Taylor Swift news for everyone to talk about.
No, it keeps on going.
She's very good at this. So, yes, it is coming to Disney Plus. As I reported in my Puck newsletter, Disney paid more than $75 million for the rights to the Taylor Swift concert film globally. And I think they're going to get a pretty significant bump out of this, subscriber-wise. The question is, how big? And I think the only real comp here as a one-off event-style moment on Disney Plus is probably when Hamilton dropped on Disney
Plus. Oh, yeah, right.
Now, that was in the summer of 2020, a very different time in the streaming wars, and obviously a very different time in the culture because everybody was signing up to streaming services during the pandemic. But when Hamilton dropped, the quarter of that, Disney Plus went from 61 million subscribers to 74 million subscribers. That's a 13 million subscriber gain. And I don't think Taylor Swift is going to match that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you look at the numbers right now, they call it Disney Plus Core, which excludes the India cricket people, the Disney Plus Hotstar in India. Disney Plus Core has 111 million subscribers right now. That's actually down from the previous quarter. And they have projected that in this quarter, they're going to gain between 5.5 and 6 million subscribers to that Disney Plus core product. So in order to beat Hamilton, Taylor Swift would have to double the Disney projections for this quarter.
And well, and I mean, when Hamilton came out, it was 2020, and Disney Plus had only been a thing for, what, a year at that time? So
yes.
There were obviously much less people who even had Disney Plus, so that jump makes sense that it was bigger.
Yeah, it was less than a year, and it was an excuse for many people to check out Disney Plus. And we're just not in the same path of the streaming wars. There also was a big price hike that contributed to the drop last quarter. So, you know, it's a lot. It's a big burden to put on Taylor Swift. And my prediction is that she will not match Hamilton in terms of subscriber growth. It's going to be big. I could see 7 million, 8 million, but it's not going to be 13 million.
Her first loss of the last 2 years.
It's not a loss. I mean, that's impossible comparisons. And I do think the minutes viewed, I mean, there are going to be fans of hers that just put this on a loop and leave it on. I mean, the minutes viewed on Nielsen, that's their metric, are going to be off the chart. I do think it's going to be clearly in the top 10. But I would be very surprised if the week this drops, it doesn't get to number one. All right, that's the show for today. I want to thank Lucas Shaw. I want to thank our producer, Craig Horbeck, our editor, Jesse Lopez, and I want to thank you. We will see you later this week.